It's the Truepenny Show with your host, James Truepenny.
Hello and welcome to the Truepenny Show. My name's James Truepenny. This is my show. I'm trying to get more enthusiastic about that. I noticed the last few were a bit flat. So I'm trying to give it some... There we go. Okay, and joining me today, as you probably guessed by her very significant laugh, it's Miss Chelsea Spallin of Shoulders Up. How are you, ma'am?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much. Well, today we're back at the Beginner's Guide to Professional Wrestling, and we're going back to 1993. Why, may you ask, are we going back to 1993 when we're clearly just starting 1996? Well, here's the thing. A lot of cool stuff happened in 1995 and 1996 that we're going to cover over the next few Beginner's Guides, and it all happened in New Japan Pro Wrestling. But unless we tell you the backstory, you won't understand a thing. So we're telling you the whole thing in a nice, easy-to-go chunk, one step at a time. Because this is complicated shit. Okay.
That way nobody's coming in the middle.
Yes. So you get everything in one go. Okay, so we're going backwards to go forwards. Okay, that's it.
Makes perfect sense.
Makes perfect sense to us. Okay. But we're going to talk today on the Beginner's Guide to Professional Wrestling in Japan about UWFI and shoot fighting. It's real! Which may be the worst or best name for a show I've ever seen.
I think the best name for a show ever is still Big Egg Wrestling Universe. I don't think anything will ever top that one. But this is good. This is in the top 20 somewhere.
It's an improvement on last week when we did the JWP show with Alex, and it was Big Project from Japan Women's Project.
Yeah.
That lacked a certain several things, but yes.
Lacked a little panache.
Yes. But we're talking about the Union of Professional Wrestling Force International, which was a successor promotion to the UWF, which we have talked about before. In fact, me and Chelsea have talked about it before because I was listening back to the old episodes to get a feel of what we needed to talk about this week. We talked about UWFI and the shoot fighting style and people like Akira Maeda and Nobuyuki Takada. And this particular company started as a direct descendant of the original, well, the reborn UWF. When that closed its doors, UWFI, or Union Wrestling Professional Wrestling Force International, was founded and based around Nobuhiko Takada. Now, the company breathed and lived that it was real wrestling, that was real. But it was just...
promise you guys, it's real.
It's real, definitely real. And to back up that realness... people like Luthers and Danny Hodge, Nick Bogwinkle and Brilly Robinson were brought in to show you how authentic it was, because nothing says authentic like grizzled old bastards that can hurt you really hard.
I mean, that's why people like Minoru Suzuki, so...
Yeah, exactly. That's it. Minoru Suzuki is essentially all of these people distilled.
The ultimate murder dad.
Yes, he is the ultimate murder dad of all the murder granddads. In fact, there you go. A host of murder granddads were brought in to support UWFI. So UWFI was this promotion. It was very desperate to make itself, give itself some credibility and separate itself from the pro wrestling pack. And to an extent, it did. Now, we're looking at 1993, so the company's about 18 months old. Now, this show we're looking at, you can find on YouTube, and we'll probably link it in, but it was actually an English language show. It was on American pay-per-view in 1993, which is nigh on... insane to think about, just because pay-per-view at the time was such an exclusory market to WCW and WWE. AWA had tried a bit and not got anywhere before they closed their doors. So this was like the first non-American wrestling company to run an American pay-per-view show. So what were your thoughts going into this, Chelsea, about what you knew about shoot wrestling and what you thought this would be like and what you thought it was like?
So going into this, honestly, I thought there was going to be a lot more matches that looked like the end of a boxing match where lots of people are covered in blood, and I was pleasantly surprised that that did not happen.
Yes.
As soon as I saw, when I was looking up the listings of stuff and I Googled a little bit about it, as soon as I saw that Luthes was on commentary for one of the matches, I was like, okay, I think I have a better sense of what this is
now.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, it's interesting. Like, catch wrestling... that's supposed to be like a shoot style it's very different from the wrestling that I watch now. Like, modern wrestling that I watch now, I feel like is very, the word I always want to use is like crisp. Like,
yeah.
I don't think crispness is the emphasis here, you know? And that's not to say, I'm not trying to say that it's like bad or not technically proficient, because pretty much all of these guys have technical chops. You know, they have, there's different fighting styles, which is interesting. But all of them can go, you know, to some extent. I just, it's sort of like a weightier thing. Like, it's more of a style that looks, it looks more, I don't know, it kind of reminds me of like when I watch judo competitions, yeah, or when I watch really any kind of professional martial arts competition, where you're more concerned about, you know, the size of one guy versus the size of the other guy, or that guy is really fast and really agile, will he actually escape the other guy? You know, like, it's, yeah, it's, there's a level of meta storytelling that I feel like is present in a lot of modern pro wrestling that isn't present in this product.
Right.
Does
okay.
that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. No, I see where you're coming from with that. There's a lot of,
like, a lot of,
I was going to say, there's a lot of, it's presented as for sport, and obviously there's a lot more emphasis on not storytelling and trying to avoid a story if at all possible.
Yeah, which is interesting because commentary, what we watched, it had English language commentary. They seemed to be trying to set up the barest bare bones of a story. And sometimes the story was just competition, but sometimes it was like, you know, that one guy's bigger than the other guy. which, you know, is the most classic wrestling story of all time. It was, yeah, it was interesting. I think when you and I were talking about this before we started, I said that I had a little bit of a hard time connecting to it.
Yeah.
And it's not like I didn't enjoy some of it. You know, there's some cool wrestling on this show. It's just, I think the thing I was missing was the storytelling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the way that I'm used to it, at least.
Yeah. I know. I mean, to me, I really enjoyed it because I hadn't watched a serious shoot card like this since the last time we looked at UWF stuff. And it was like, it was nice to get it with American commentary on it, just so that you could understand a bit more about what was going on.
Sure.
We should start about talk about the commentary, because the commentary was insane.
Because yes, they were.
It was like, okay, so you've got two guys in suits. I think Greg Pelkin, I can't remember the other guy's name, but essentially it was your standard play-by-play and color announcer. But it was like your Ron Burgundy of wrestling announcers. It was as if they were doing it. It was so straight-laced, it had to be I'm trying to think of the word. It had to be like a parody of what pro wrestling commentators should be. And it was, I mean, they were clearly into it, but if you imagine two guys trying to impersonate Howard Cosell doing wrestling commentary, that's what you got, really.
See, it took me about halfway through the show to figure out that they were fucking with me intentionally. Like, I didn't, because before they started talking about Bad News Allen and they were like, look at those rippling muscles, I wasn't really like 100% sure that the parody was the goal and that it wasn't just really, really silly. And then I was like, wait a minute, this is from 1993, not, you know, 1973.
Yeah.
Okay, I get this now. Yeah. But it did take a while because it was just, it was jarring to me at first. It was like, what is going on?
Yeah, it's just like, it is like the two guys, if you've ever seen Semi-Pro, which is a Will Ferrell movie about basketball, and there's two commentators who commentate for the local ABA basketball team, and they're just terrible. They're just like, the color guys just smokes through the entire show. The play-by-play guy is the most generic commentator ever. And it was just like them two are playing to a wrestling show. Not to say it was bad, because it was informative, but it was, every time you listen to it, it is just like, where did they find you two people? Because I want to go there. Because it must be such a lovely place.
You know what, honestly, like, I'm on a WWE hiatus at the moment. I'm not watching their product. And listening to a style of commentary that was just the complete polar opposite of everything WWE tries to do with their commentary was actually really refreshing.
Yeah.
It was nice.
Yeah. It was. Because, I mean, to be fair to them, their job was to explain this thing that was completely different to any of the other things that you've ever seen on wrestling television.
And I mean, you're also trying to explain this thing that, like, to some extent, if it's a shoot fight, you can't explain it too much, because if you do, then it's very obviously not a shoot fight.
Yes, which it isn't a shoot fight. It's shoot fighting.
Right.
But it's not a shoot.
So,
yes. So, you know, and again, they are trying to present it as quote-unquote real, when it's really not. It is booked, you know. But, yeah. We'll move on, because, yeah, we'll get to the first matches. Now, there was two dark matches that weren't on the tape, and if you find it on YouTube, you won't see these. Yoshihiro Takeyama defeated WCW jobber Tom Burton in 11 minutes and 12 seconds. I want to see that. Takeyama was wrestling up until last year, when sadly had an accident whilst wrestling for DDT Pro and broke his neck. He's currently in hospital recovering, but sadly will be paralyzed from the neck down, and is the toughest old bastard in pro wrestling, and one of the toughest old guys.
That's awful.
Yeah, he's something else. He really is. He's a force of nature. You know, we talked about him before. He had a stroke not long after this and came back to pro wrestling. It's the reason why he has one of those stroke faces. You know, he has a sunken face. He fought Don Fry in a MMA fight one night and went the full 15 rounds in Pride. And from what ringside observers said, they could hear the tendon snapping. And they both got up and got back to MMA after that. And they were he's just tough. He's just double tough. And the first thing he said when they stretched him out of the arena was to the promoter of DDT, "I'm sorry."
That's sad.
It is so sad.
At least he got to have a good long career before he had to retire, but still, you never want to hear about somebody getting paralyzed. No. That's just awful.
No, just awful. Minoru Suzuki's best friend. And one of the reasons why we really supported the Real Hero Archive when it was going was because the people that put financial support into Real Hero Archive put money towards Takeyama's recovery fund, which was really, really
cool.
Yeah,
I remember that. I remember seeing the links on Twitter.
Yeah, really, really cool. But yes, Yoshihiro, sadly, well, he's with us. He's alive. He ain't dead, so we'll go with that. But he's doing better. You know, he's doing cool stuff. So Yoshihiro and Tom Burton. He's back up, by the way, he's back on Instagram as Yoshihiro.
Huh.
God bless him. He's not going to let paralysis stop his Instagram.
Yeah. Maybe he wanted to look at Minoru Suzuki's cat pictures. I can't blame him.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, there you go, you see. That's the thing. Find out what Despy's up to this week. Moving on, the second match. Gene Liddick defeated Greg Bobichick in 7 minutes and 37 seconds. You did get a lot of American fighters on these shows, by the way. There was a lot of gay Gene, and we will talk about them as we go through the show. A lot of them from the Tennessee area, much like the guys in PWFG were a lot of them from the Florida area, like Ken Shamrock and so on. They tended to pick one gym, and people tended to gravitated towards that. Though there is one guy who we'll talk about a bit later was actually from Philadelphia, and we will talk about him in a while. The first match on the show, though, is Yoji Angelo, and he defeated Tatsuya Nakano, he of the glorious mullet, in 9 minutes and 22 seconds. Yes, we're talking about hair, because I've talked about little else all week. what did you think of this matchup, Chelsea?
This was interesting. Anjo moves like a video game character.
Yes.
Like, there are... It really down to... Like, if you ever play a fighting game and you're just getting used to the controls, when you first start learning how to make your character kick things, they'll do a move really, really quickly, and then there's this very deliberate pause at the end, which is how the programmers have to set it up so that it looks fluid and connected when it goes into the next move, and like, he throws kicks that way. Like, he has really amazing body control. It was impressive watching him like shift his weight around. Nakano, I don't think I had quite as many thoughts about his style so much, but I thought they seemed to work well together. They seemed to know what to do. I did think it was interesting that commentary went out of their way to present them both as very nice guys. Like, they actually used those words for both of them. He's a very nice guy, very good guy. When they were talking about Nakano, they specifically said, they're like, well, if you're heading into a dark alley, not just that you like want to fear this guy, but like you want this guy by your side. I was like, really? I wasn't expecting that. That was totally counterintuitive to me. But I mean, I guess there's nothing wrong with that. Maybe they were trying to set you up to like both of them without a lot of information.
Yeah.
But I thought that was really an interesting choice. I did get my back up a little bit when they were trying to characterize the style of the fight by talking about the fact that they were both Japanese. I'm like, can you guys pick something to talk about that actually has to do with what's happening in the fight? You know, they have to defend all aspects of the sport. I'm like, are you telling me that American wrestlers on this show wouldn't get defensive if you were trying to talk to them about what their sport is? But I liked this match. I enjoyed it. And I think the audience enjoyed it, too. They seemed like they were excited for it.
Yeah. Nakano's a Carl Gott student. You know, he's been around for a while at this point. And Anjo was like their up-and-coming babyface star. Anjo, as we've mentioned before, was the one who went and challenged Hoist Gracie in Brazil.
That sounds like a bad time.
Yeah, went badly. He turned up with a press corps outside of Hoist's gym. And Hoist said, lock the door. Don't let them in. And then he said, right, you let him in, but just him. And he can have a representative with him. And they came in, there was a translator, and there was a representative from UWFI, and they discussed it. And he said, do you want to come to Japan for a fight? I said, no, here now. Okay, then. they go in the ring, and he beat the shit out of Anjo, as was perfectly presented, and said, now open the door and let the press in. And of course they saw Anjo walking out with blood streaked across his face and a broken face. So there you go.
I'm a little sad for him hearing that, but I also think he should have known better.
Yes. Know your limitations. As Dirty Harry once said. Man's got to know his limitations, which is very true. But yeah, it was fun. And Anjo has bags of charisma as well. And so does Nakano. Has this kind of like, he's such a blank faced dude. There's nothing going on there, but it's kind of fascinating in its own way. If you see what I mean. There are guys.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, he has that easy nothingness to him that makes for a good jobber.
Yeah. I think he was a bit more than that, but you know, he's interchangeable, isn't he? Let's be honest.
Well, I mean, I think at least in this match.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that there aren't other settings where he could stand out more, but I think in this match for sure, and I think he knows Anjo is the star.
Yeah.
Like, and Anjo is the more, I don't want to say more extroverted because it's hard to tell because they're wrestling, not talking, but he seems like the more extroverted, like more vibrant personality that the press is going to gravitate towards a little bit more.
Then, you know, like most New Japan booking, you know, it's all for the company, because if the company does well, you do well. You know, Mike Skull was talking to Jim Ross on his podcast a couple of weeks ago about Zack Sabre Jr. going through the entire New Japan roster during the New Japan Cup, and Marty Skull said, yeah, everyone does business here. That's the way it is. He said when I first started wrestling in America, cross-faced chicken wing was not popular in the dressing room. whereas Japan, yeah, do business, because you got to do business, because that's how we make a living. So, yeah, it's the Japanese companies are quite happy for this kind of stuff to happen, but Japanese wrestlers didn't mind losing, because their time will come if you work hard enough and you've got the thing. So there you go. But anywho, shall we move on to the next one?
Yeah.
Okay, Dennis Kozlowski defeated Masahito Kakihara in 8 minutes and 55 seconds. Now, Dennis Kozlowski was a amateur wrestler who was made the Olympic team, was going to the next Olympics, which was in, I can't remember, the next one was 94, it'd been 96, wouldn't it? Atlanta, yeah. He was going to the Atlanta Olympics. He was a solid wrestler in this bout. He matches the style because he's got that kind of like submission freestyle wrestling approach to it. He was a good looking kid, well built, everything you'd want in a wrestler. Don't understand why he came to the ring as to Born to Run, because that's not entrance music material. You don't want, you know, a song about the nihilism of the American dream and the hopelessness of Midwestern lack of forward progress in industrialized unionization's thinking.
See, I think unfortunately a lot of people who really like that song don't understand how nihilistic it actually is.
No, like Reagan quoting the words from Born in the USA is a great, you know, it's like, no. have you actually listened to it? Yeah, it's not really about that. Sorry, Ron.
Yeah. No, I think, unfortunately, I think Bruce Springsteen speaks to people on such a gut level that they can't quite get at the actual intended implications of a lot of the things he says.
Yes, exactly.
Which I think is part of why he's successful.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Actually, did you know, this is an aside, but did you know that CBS insisted he went to the gym before Born to Run was before Born to Run was released, so he'd look better for the videos?
Wow. Well, I mean, he looked okay in those videos, so yeah. I think it worked out. But that kind of takes away the everyman aesthetic he was probably going for to some extent.
True. But yeah, it hella worked for a long period of time. He still looks ripped today. He's like, you know, was he 65, 67, and he looks better than I do, and I'm 44. Anywho, let us move on. Is it Masahito Kakihara? Yeah, who was a young man with a lot going for him. I thought he was good looking. He had the look. He had all the moves. He moved really, really quickly.
Yes.
Again, I think this is kind of like the show up of perhaps the problem with this wrestling as far as a mass audience is concerned is there's essentially only three or four finishes within the style and everybody uses them. So it becomes harder to identify people by individual styles, though they're all different. It's harder, like, you look someone as an example, we'll use New Japan as an example because that's what I watch the most. I can tell the difference between Tetsuya Naito and Kazuchika Okada. Even though they had similar backgrounds, they wrestle completely differently. Even though they both use elements of lucha, they both use elements of strong style, there's a different approach to pro wrestling. They get to the same end product with a different way of doing things, whereas a lot of this is the same way of doing things with slight tweaks, which unless you are absolutely really, really into it, it's not a casual fan's kind of thing that they can grasp really easily.
That's a really good point.
Yeah. And then having said that, Kozlowski and Kakihara had two very, very different styles. And I think this what made this match much more watchable for me was because they were going about the same thing in two different ways.
You know, that's a good point. I could tell they had I don't want to necessarily, I mean, maybe the word really just is chemistry. Like they understood each other, but also, you know, they just both looked so different and moved so differently.
Yeah.
I don't know. I had a hard time with this match because I was looking for more story in it, I think. And I think I hadn't quite given up on that being a thing. I think that's just a thing that I want from wrestling more than I realized. But I mean, I thought that if you're somebody who really likes technical wrestling, I think this match is probably something you will like because you do get to see some interesting submissions. You get to see what happens, you know, when you have someone who is good at mat wrestling going up against somebody who's really good at kicking.
Yeah.
Which is a classic kind of clash that seems to always work. And both of those guys are very charismatic, and they're very, very different. Also, I feel like I need to say, just as an aside, that American flag singlets are always terrible.
Unless it's Kurt Angle, whose were intentionally terrible.
Yes. I feel like intentionally terrible is kind of the Kurt Angle aesthetic.
Yes.
But yeah. They're just bad, and nobody should wear them.
Yeah,
that's my personal opinion.
Yes, because essentially you're just wrapping your junk in the American flag. And how disrespectful is that? And in fact, yeah, I believe if it is not the true case after all that drizzling crap about flag burning 2 years ago, that one of the things you're not supposed to do is to turn it into a tire. like the list of respect for the Stars and Stripes, one of the things on there is don't wear it.
I mean, listen, if Beyonce wants to wear it, I'm not going to get mad about it. Or Rihanna or something like that. You know, something genuinely patriotic, I'm going to be fine with it. But, like, don't wear it to wrestle. Just sweat to death in something else.
Oh, dear. Yeah, anyway. So where was we? Yes, Kozlowski versus Kakeara. Yeah, perfectly watchable match. I enjoyed it. It was fun, but again, it's not going to be everybody's cup of tea. Something that was perhaps a bit more to our kind of Western ears and eyes more pleasing was Kazuyo Yamazaki, who was one of the bookers for UWF International, get it right, versus Bad News Allen, or Bad News Brown from the WWF, 30 minutes and 34 seconds. Lots of people did not realize this in the 1980s, but Bad News Brown, who was a kind of in between heel in his WWF run, was a bad, bad, bad man. He was a judo champion. He was, that was the character he played, but he kind of amped it up for comedic purposes. But here's a guy who was a bronze medalist in the Olympics at judo, trained for wrestling by Stu Hart. He knew what he was doing when it came to looking after himself.
He trained with Stu Hart, and that's why all the Canadians know him. I get it.
Yes.
Now.
So yeah, because he was a bad man. reading in Dynamite Kid's book, one of the first feuds Bret Hart had in his career was with Bad News Allen, and he begged his dad to take a break. That's why Dynamite got the job, because he knocked seven bells out of people. That's what he did. You know, it was his style, because he was the heel, and that's what he had to do, and he made it look realistic. So it's really interesting watching a guy like this in an environment like this. And it's also interesting because one of the things about this show is they're saying it's real. And of course, but here you have Bad News Allen, who in his other life is the most gimmicky of gimmick wrestlers. And they put him late on the card in the American show, because why wouldn't you? Because you want to draw American audiences. But he is still essentially doing the things he did in the WWF in this style, but he's not using any of the trademark things he does in his WWF run, because he can't, because the style dictates that he wrestles quote-unquote properly. So it's really...
That's really interesting, because I've seen that guy wrestle a bunch before, and I couldn't... Not a bunch, but I've probably seen three or four different things that he's done that were, you know, lengthy enough to get a sense of his style.
Yeah.
And I wondered why this felt so different, and I couldn't put my finger on it.
Yeah, I think because he's not gesticulating with the audience. He's not, you know, he was the reason why the Hart Foundation turned face in the WWF, because the Battle Royal at WrestleMania... WrestleMania 4, the Battle Royal WrestleMania 4, he won when Bret was the last person in the ring, and he threw Bret outside the ring, and that's what turned the Hart Foundation face, you know. So that's, yeah, he's the he was a good catalyst wrestler. He had a killer feud with Roddy Piper, even though Roddy chose a way of celebrating his racism that he perhaps shouldn't have done. You heard about that story?
Sorry?
You heard about that story?
No.
That was WrestleMania 6. There was a big feud between Roddy Piper and Bad News Allen. And when he came down the aisle, Roddy had painted half his body black. And I was watching it at the time and going like, why? I mean, Roddy's idea was that he was, like, you know, showing, like, love to the black fans in the audience, but it's like, yeah, I'm not sure they felt that way, Roddy.
That's so bad.
What made it even worse was he thought he was using, like, temporary body paint, but somebody had swapped it out for permanent body paint. So he had to go through every airport for the next 2 weeks with half, literally half his body, not like his legs or his top half his body, his left-hand side, painted black.
I'm going to say he deserved it.
Yes, yes. I was wondering if it was one of the black wrestlers in the dressing room who possibly did it.
You know, whoever did that, I mean, maybe they didn't do it intentionally, but it sure sounds like maybe they did. And good job.
Yeah.
Good job, whoever did that. Cause he
sounds
totally
like a Mr. Perfect deal or a Mr. Fuji deal. They were King Ribbers at the time in the WWE.
Nobody, yeah, that sort of makes sense.
Nobody dare out-rib Mr. Fuji. No one was allowed because they knew he would do terrible, terrible things to you. anywho, so yeah, it was definitely an interesting match. Is there anything else you want to say about this one, Chelsea?
Man, this one is weird. Like, it doesn't feel like anything else on this card. It's really slow.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, you can tell, if you didn't know any of that background about Bad News Allen, which, like, I knew some of the things you said, but there was, you know, still sort of overall context missing for me there. If you did not know that that guy really, for real, knew how to fuck somebody up real bad, you could tell from the totally, like he moves at somebody, like, he doesn't care how his body looks at all to the audience. Like, he doesn't care how the movement looks. He just instinctually knows, if I do this, that other guy's going to be in a lot of pain.
Yes.
And, he has that, it's beyond confidence. It's like the killer instinct thing that some people have. It's very interesting. I did not know what to make of this match when I watched it, and now I sort of feel like maybe I need to rewatch it.
Yeah, I mean, Yamazaki's good, but, like, Yamazaki's thing was kicking, and he doesn't throw any kicks in this match at all. It's like, I know it's supposed to be real, and perhaps kicking isn't the way to go with Bad News Allen because he's got those big, thick tree trunk legs, and he doesn't really feel pain, so if you keep kicking him, he's not going to really notice, and he knows how to defend against things. But surely, again, it's a wrestling match in a non-shooty kind of way, so you showcase the bit that you're good at.
I mean, you can see Yamazaki shake his head a couple of times when they go to lock up.
Yeah.
Like, he's scared of what's going to happen next. And I sort of can't blame him.
No. There was another comment on the commentary I could have done without, which was, how would you like Bad News Allen in your neighborhood? And we're like, whoa, hang on. Step back there. I know what you're trying to say, but it doesn't sound like what you're trying to say. Anywho.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, the 90s, when we were so young and so much more racist. Anyway, moving on. So the next match, the second last match, was Salman Hashimikov? And Vladimir Bukovic. They defeated Dan the Beast Severin and Gary Albright in 13 minutes and 9 seconds. Now, this was really interesting because Hashimikov and Burkov had actually, we've talked about them before. In fact, we've reviewed their matches before, Chelsea.
So, like, I knew the names, and I sort of recognized their faces, but I didn't go back and watch anything to see, like, what I was really looking at to try to give myself more context. So I probably should have.
You remember back in when we very started this, like, 4 years ago? No, it wasn't. About 2 years ago. When me, you, and Marcus looked at that New Japan card we found off Russian YouTube.
Is that the show that I did on 1 hour of sleep? That kind of sounds like the show I did on 1 hour of sleep.
Where we looked at New Japan's early, I think it was 1989, when they went behind the Iron Curtain and they did that show in Moscow. And they were on that. Those guys were on that.
Interesting.
Yes. And they had runs. They had a 4-year run in New Japan Pro Wrestling. Hashimikov ended up being IWGP heavyweight champion. He lost it to Riki Choshu. So, you know, they were considered top-line pros, but they wrestled that style in New Japan. Then they come to UWF after that, so that relationship has ended. And they're kind of made for UWF, really. They've got minimal pro experience. They keep it as real as they possibly can. And you give them two guys like Dan Severn and Gary Albright. Well, Gary Albright was Nebraska amateur. He was really, really good. Never really caught on in North America as Mukken Singh's brother. I can't remember which Singh he was, but he was, you know, in Japan, where he could be an amateur style wrestler and really work his magic, he was awesome. Dan the Beast Severin, you know, he really is what you saw in his big run in the WWE. Me and Alex talked about him on the IWA King of Death matches a couple of years after this, where he's NWA heavyweight champion, and he has a very, very good match with Tarzan Goto. But this was kind of his ball game. This is exactly what he did really, really well. Still has the worst kicks in pro wrestling history, and he shouldn't have bothered. But This was much more of a pro wrestling style match in the layout. It was a tag match. Now, UWFI tag matches, as you'd imagine, there's no double teams or anything like that. You tag out, you get your new guy in. You have to let go of the person. If they make it back to the corner, that's tough luck. But this was a lot of fun to watch and a lot more like a wrestling match. And a lot less kick heavy, apart from Dan trying really hard, bless him. But other than that, this worked really, really well. And, you know, you can see the charisma that Albright has. And Severin doesn't really have a ton of charisma, but he uses it really well. And Burkov and Hashimokov actually kind of like get some things going and they do some cool stuff. And it was actually, I think, a better platform for them than New Japan was. So what did you think of this, Chelsea?
So this is definitely more familiar to me than some of the previous matches on this card. I don't know that stylistically that the wrestling is the kind of wrestling that I get super, super emotionally invested in, but I mean, I could tell that everybody in it was really good and knew what they were doing. I had a little bit of, I don't know, I guess I was a little disappointed again that there wasn't more story, because I feel like story and emotional tension are the things that I really enjoy about tag matches, you know? Really... That's kind of the candy there for me,
yeah.
Interestingly enough. It was interesting how many guys there are in this match who are, like, really, really big, beefy guys who have, you know, who are very adept at mat wrestling and just, like, straight up picking somebody up and tossing them around, but not in an unfocused kind of way, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I wasn't a huge fan of seeing a couple people get suplexed on their heads, because that happens.
Yeah.
But there is some interesting technical grappling in this match. I don't know. I'm sorry, James. I feel bad because I want to like it and have something more interesting to say. I don't know. I think this maybe wasn't my cup of tea.
That's fair enough. I mean this card isn't necessarily everyone's cup of tea. But unless we explain this, the next bit doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is a long-term narrative. But we picked the one that is most likely to connect with you because it's English language commentary. So trust us. Just trust us. It'll all be okay. one match actually we missed out, which was a dark match, which was put on later in the show. Luthes, by the way, commentated on that match. And I thought he was really good as a commentator.
Yeah, I was surprised actually too when they showed him on camera, because I was trying to place this in my head with having read some of his biography.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, oh wow, okay. I wasn't used to seeing him that. I guess I wasn't used to seeing him that old.
No. I mean, he did do commentary. One of the first tapes I bought of wrestling was from mid 70s Tennessee, I think IWA, or it may have been one of the IWAs where Mil Máscaras was a big star, which will tell you how long ago it was. He did commentary on that, and he was really, really good. I was really into it, you know. And the way Thez thought about this particular company was, he supported them. He even gave them his 1950s NWA World Heavyweight Championship as the real World Heavyweight Championship, which they used a lot until towards the end of the company, when they started to kind of like run out of challengers and they've not made any new stars, and they started being a bit more like a wrestling company. And Lou took away his endorsement on the grounds that I don't mind New Japan supporting them, because they never said they were a wrestling. They were real. You know, they're just a wrestling company. Whereas you're saying you're real, and therefore you are. I understand that sometimes you have to do things politically to make things work, but this is not real. So therefore, I'm no longer going to support you. So that's one of the nails in the coffin of the company. But there was bigger stories to talk about that, which we'll talk about in future podcasts. Let's go back to this match that we missed out, though. Hiromitsu Kanahara defeated Tommy Kairo in 3 minutes and 49 seconds. Some interesting things in this. This was a part of their junior division. Now, their junior division wasn't a weight division. It was an experience division. So if you had only just qualified, you weren't allowed to wrestle in the senior league until you'd put some time in the junior league. Now, Kanahara had just graduated the UWFI dojo, and Tommy Kairo was an American pro from Philadelphia and was one of the original ECW guys around about this time, which is really weird to see him in this environment when you're used to seeing him in bingo halls and Hammond track and odd places like that. But yeah, this actually worked really well. What did you think of this?
I thought this was good. It's definitely, I definitely liked it, I think, more than the tag match. It's another one where I struggle to find interesting things to say about it because it's a type of wrestling I don't really know if I know how to talk about. I thought both of those guys were really charismatic. I thought Kanehara seemed like somebody who kind of had that quality of, like, you know when you see in New Japan the young lion who hasn't gone off on excursion yet, but you can tell that when they do and then they come back, they're going to be somebody?
Yeah, yeah.
That was kind of the vibe that I got. I was like, okay, that guy's not somebody yet, but in, like, a couple years.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, no, I know what you mean. Yeah, he's going to get... He had certain softness to him, and, like, you could see him being a babyface and doing really well.
Yeah, he was very earnest, which I liked. Tommy Cairo, I didn't really know very much about, but he was really good. I thought it was interesting that commentary went out of their way to talk about those two guys being less experienced than everybody else, because, I mean... I guess maybe they were, but it sort of didn't feel that way watching the match. It sort of felt like maybe they were less established than everybody else, but not less experienced.
Yeah, definitely. I think that was it. I think, again, when you have a minimal of storyline elements, anything you can put in the environment to help support a story is useful.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting stories about Tommy Cairo, if you listen to Mike Freeland's other podcast, the Front Row Material with Jerry Lynn and Mikey Whipwreck. Mikey Whipwreck was partly trained by Tommy Cairo. I think he was talking about him on a couple of episodes ago.
That's pretty cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so there you go. Should strongly recommend Front Row Material if you like the history of wrestling and don't mind lots of swearing and scatological stories and all sorts of grim stuff that went on in ECW, as you can imagine, in the early 90s. It's well worth a listen. But yeah, go and have a listen to that. Follow Mike Freeland. I think they're at FM Front Row Material. Anyway, you search that on social media, you'll find it. Okay. Then we get to the main event. Nobuyuki Takada, who was the star of the promotion, defeated Billy Scott in 13 minutes in a thoroughly enjoyable matchup. And now this was kind of obvious that Nobuyuki Takada was going to win because he had 20 pounds on Billy Scott, judging by the title of the tape at the start of the show. And it's like, Takada's the guy and Billy Scott is not the guy. He's a nice guy, clearly. He looked really cool and had an outstanding mullet. Possibly the truest, most classical mullet of all the mullets we've seen on this show. This is an arena that doesn't lend itself to the mullet, obviously, but Gary Albright, Billy Scott, and Tatsuya Nakano are holding the mullet end, if you will, quite well. But back to actual serious wrestling. Nobuyuki Takada, you can tell why he's the star. He looks like a star, he acts like a star, he wrestles like a star, he's got the look, he can make things look interesting. The things you want to see in a lead babyface are there. And this match with Billy Scott was a very good match to watch, I thought, within the style. I don't know how you feel about it, though, Chelsea.
I actually really enjoyed it. Physically, I think Takada reminded me a little bit of Shibata.
Yes.
Not so much stylistically, like, in terms of the actual way he wrestled, but just, like, his presence and his look. When he came out, I was like, oh, okay, wow. I have to say, I was very surprised that the two dudes in this match are wearing pastel trunks in cool colors. They had Takada in sort of like a light purple, and Billy Scott is in like a teal blue, and that was really interesting. I was kind of like, I don't know who picked the Easter colors, but I like it.
Web 2.0 wrestling.
Yeah, it's interesting. Billy Scott is definitely, not the guy in this match. You feel a little bad for him because he does take some pretty stiff kicks, and he gets a big reaction from the crowd when he tries to recover, but, I mean, you can tell the crowd is, like, 100% behind Takada whenever he lands something really big. Everybody gasps, and, you know, there's a lot of enthusiasm when he gets Billy Scott into a really nasty looking submission right after kicking him a whole bunch of times. There's some interesting mat wrestling in this match that I think people will like if you really like technical wrestling. And there's also some interesting striking. It's it is interesting how I think Takada is one of those guys where you don't necessarily need a super deep wrestling story to make him interesting to watch.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because he's just so good that, like, you're just sort of, you want to see what that guy is going to do. And
yeah.
Not everybody has that quality. A lot of people don't. So it totally made sense. Like, as soon as these guys came out for the main event, I was like, yeah, I get why this is the main event.
Yeah.
I kind of wish there had been, like, a lot of the struggling they have in this match feels very even-handed, even though the crowd's reaction to it is not, you know, the crowd is 100% behind Takada the whole time. I sort of wish there had been, like, a little more of a, I guess just a little more of a power imbalance there, but again, that's me hungering for more story.
Yeah.
But I do think this is enjoyable. Like, it was definitely fun to watch, and it's totally not like a lot of modern wrestling products that you watch now. So if you are looking for something more unique, this may be enjoyable.
Yeah, I mean,
for you.
I think as well there's lots of references in this into modern day wrestling. I mean, Zack Sabre Jr. is the obvious answer. I mean, I definitely saw orienteering with Napalm Death in this show. I can't remember who did it, but I definitely saw that move. And, you know, that kind of style that's much more fluid, obviously influences on Shinsuke Nakamura as well, that kind of fluid, strong style.
Makes sense. You know, I hadn't thought about that, but, like, that, yes, absolutely. Now that you've said that, I 100%
yeah.
agree.
Yeah, so there's lots of stuff going on here that you see in modern-day wrestling, but it wasn't a style that was sustainable, in much the same way as ECW and FMW weren't sustainable companies because of the attrition you go through. These guys weren't wrestling every night. They were only wrestling once a month because of the wear and tear it takes on your body. But equally, that means there's 30 nights in the month you're not earning money, and you've got to run a dojo, and you've got to do all this stuff, you know, and so therefore ticket prices have to be higher. Now, they're clearly doing good business. This particular show in 1993, it was in October, and it was an attendance of 5,900 at Osaka Prefectural Gymnasium, Osaka Joe Hall, or Osaka Odeon Arena as we know it today, a standout New Japan arena where, you know, they had Power Struggle not too long ago. So, you know, it's a built wrestling arena. They do wrestling well there even to this day. But it is just like, you can't do this style of thing that often because you can't. Because you would plow through wrestlers at an alarming rate of knots. And it's not like they can go off and take indie bookings anywhere else because that will ruin their credibility. The American guys can because the Japanese fans aren't seeing Tom Burton getting his head kicked in on WCW television.
Right.
But they would see Yamazaki going doing some jobs for all Japan. You can't do that. So they have to protect their aura. So you've got to keep these guys paid and off the road. So this is where really the rub comes in with this catch style, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, I hadn't really thought about that because I feel like when you're looking at catch wrestling for the first time, you don't necessarily think of how brutal it actually is, right?
Yeah.
Like, it looks safer than a lot of modern wrestling styles that I'm used to watching that I consider unsafe. It looks safer than a ladder match, you know? It looks safer than, like, a lot of the gruesome stuff that people did in ECW. But it's also a wrestling style that's, like, designed around fundamentals that will actually hurt people.
Yes.
And I mean, all the guys that did it, like, just reading a little bit of Luthez's biography, and he talks about, like, how physically demanding it really was, and talks about it, you know, it's talked about in his biography in, like, a very, nonchalant way, but, like, it's definitely really brutal, and you sort of forget that, because all of the people who made it to this level were such good performers that they could just kind of brush it off while they were doing what they were doing. But yeah, that's interesting. I think in the 90s in particular, we seem to end up having a lot of conversations about sustainability in wrestling, right? Because it feels like there were a lot of wrestling products that were trying exciting and weird things that other people weren't trying, that just kind of flamed out because what they were doing was just not something that was going to work long term. And I sorry, I'm babbling.
No, you're right. No, I think you're right there. I mean, certainly we saw that with AJW. We're just getting into a down period for AJW where they try and make a more sustainable product and try and make new stars. And certainly there's a lot. You look at All Japan, they've just started their upward growth curve. Well, no, they're kind of into it in 93. They've moved along in 93. They're on the cusping their upward growth curve, which is going to last for over a decade.
Yeah.
With those wrestlers, not necessarily with that company, but definitely with those wrestlers. So, you know, All Japan is the one taking steady steps and going more and more and more one step at a time, whereas the other companies are tending to explode their styles and do something completely different, which has the problem of being a flash in the pan if you're not careful. You know,
yeah.
And, you know, we talked about AJW not being sustainable because you couldn't burn through all those matches that they did. We talked about it last week in JWP. They burned through too many matches too quickly or gave matches away to other companies too quickly. They couldn't sustain themselves at a higher level for that long. You know, it became a lot harder to sustain themselves because they'd given away all their stories or they'd sold all their stories. So, yeah, this is a good example of that. You build up stars at this particular point that they were trying to build out. They built Gary Albright. Obviously, Takada was a top star. But you still, you know, Bad News Allens was going up as well. But, you know, it's difficult as well. You can't just book it like you do a traditional wrestling company because it's supposed to be real. So, therefore, there are upsets. You know, you sometimes have to disrupt a push. Because you have to be reflective of the fact that the other guy is just as good. So, you know, it becomes harder and harder to make money with this in the long run. You know, All Japan kind of ran into similar problems, but in a different way, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. But this is great from a new idea point of view, but it's also problematic from a sustaining a living point of view. But it's an interesting watch, certainly. And I think even just from a historical point of view, you should take a look to see how wrestling can be done differently. And, of course, there's modern-day wrestlers. We were talking about Shona Baszler recently, who essentially wrestles like this, but with a bit more of a kind of storytelling arc to it.
Yeah. And, I mean, you know, that was, for me, a long time, the disconnect with Shayna was that she was either too much like herself when she was just doing MMA and wasn't doing pro wrestling, or she was doing pro wrestling but trying so hard very carefully not to actually hurt people, which was really, really difficult for her. And now she's got that balance. Like she just has it, and you just believe her character. And I definitely watched this and I thought about her a few times. I was like, you know, this is totally some of the building blocks that went into making what she does possible.
Yeah, definitely now. Yeah. And also, I mean, as well, we've got some, just to give you some more lineage things, our friends at Catch Wrestling, which you can follow on Twitter, at Catch Wrestling, noticed we were talking about this because they tapped into our mullet talk. and was like, oh yeah, Billy Scott was one of Billy Robinson's trainees. He runs a wrestling school now, and he gave us links, so we'll link that up as well in the conversation. And you should follow Catch Wrestling because they do some fascinating stuff about the early days of pro wrestling and how MMA's been infected by pro wrestling and what pro wrestling is like in the real wrestling sense. They were the ones that turned us on to the Catch Wrestling Championships at Wigan for the Snake Pit and things like that. So you should follow them because they have some interesting takes on what pro wrestling is if you want your pro wrestling to be that bit different. And it's interesting as well. I mean, it's one of those conversations we had, like, being real. I had a conversation with a Twitter guy a few months ago, and he said, wrestling isn't realistic anymore. And I said, well, you've obviously never seen Minoru Suzuki then, have you?
Oh, God, seriously?
Yeah, and I sent him some Minoru Suzuki stuff, and he said, but that doesn't look realistic to me. And I'm like, but...
Well, that's a personal problem.
Yeah, and I was like, but he is one of the founding fathers of MMA. He is trained by Billy Robinson and Carl Gotch. You don't get any more real than Minoru Suzuki. And then he explained that he wanted an older style of wrestling that he thought was real. So reality in pro wrestling is very much in the eye of the beholder, you know. And to be fair to him, I explained, look, here's where you want to go. And I sent him off to West Coast Wrestling company up there, WCWC in Pacific Northwest in Portland, who do...
Mm.
It's modern stars. It's people like Joey Ryan and guys like that. And they go up there and they're all mainstream stars, but they wrestle in a traditional Saturday morning at 10 o'clock kind of way, which is really what he's looking for. He's not looking for reality per se. He's looking for the reality he's been taught.
That's interesting.
Yeah, which is, you know, which is interesting because it's like, That's different to what we kind of see in wrestling nowadays. And I mean, all wrestling's awesome, whether it's, you know, a town hall on a Saturday night or whether it's WrestleMania. It's all awesome, and I love it all, but it doesn't mean that the town hall is any less valid than WrestleMania. It's all good, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah.
You wouldn't get the WrestleMania without the town hall.
No, you wouldn't. So, yes. Support all wrestling where you can and find new and different ways and tell people about it and explain it and be nice.
Yes, be nice. Being nice is really important.
Yes, be nice about it. Yes. No gatekeepers around here. Right then. Thank you very much for your time today and listening to the show, to listening to the Troopity Show.
Sorry,
long week.
Really funny.
Long week, Ben. Gotta do concerts on Monday. I'm gonna be awesome at school. Right. Thank you very much for listening to The Troopany Show. My name has been James Troopany, and will continue to be James Troopany for the rest of my life, I assume. I don't know. Next week, I might call myself Deborah. Anyway, thank you very much to Chelsea for her contribution today.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
You can find her at Shoulders Up and at Chelsea Comics on Twitter, but mainly at Shoulders Up, where she talks about wrestling.
Yes.
Indeed. You can find me at Sheriff Lone Star on Twitter. You can find the show at Troopany Show on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook, The Troopany Show. And you can find us on Patreon, The Troopany Show, where you can keep The Troopany Show free forever for everyone. Mike Freeland is back. He no longer has a voice that makes him sound like a horse chewing thumbtacks. So he can do a show this week. I think he's on his own this week. So go give Mike some love. And thank you for listening to the show and the positive comments we received about it, because I really enjoy that show. And it's nice to listen to somebody different on our network. So thank you very much for listening to us. Mike will be with you on Wednesday. Next week, I believe we'll be back with the Beginner's Guide to Professional Wrestling with the next segment of the UWFI story. So until then, take care, and we'll see you soon. Bye.